Good afternoon, and welcome to the May meeting of our 386th, that's for anyone who's been counting, of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations, coming to you today from the Midcoast of Maine, and a particularly warm welcome to our radio audience. My name is Mac DeFord. I'm the head of the forum, which was founded in 1983 by a small group of area residents with a special interest in U.S. foreign policy and our role in international affairs. We meet on a monthly basis to hear retired foreign policy officials, academics, journalists, and international businessmen discuss important foreign policy issues. Our membership, which is currently about 230, includes not just those who are interested in foreign affairs, but as well many who have lived and worked abroad and have considerable expertise about many of the issues discussed. For additional information, please see our website, midcoastforum.org. Today, we're delighted to have as our speaker, Hedrick Smith. He's been one of our most distinguished journalists for the last half century. In 26 years with the New York Times, he covered the key historical events of the era, Martin Luther King Jr. and the Civil Rights Movement, the Vietnam War, the Middle East conflict, the Cold War. He was a member of the Pulitzer Prize-winning team that revealed the Pentagon Papers. He won a Pulitzer again in 1974 for his reporting from Russia and Eastern Europe. His book, The Russians, based on his experiences there, was the number one bestseller in the mid-70s. He followed up that up with another bestseller, and reportedly it was bedside reading for President Clinton, The Power Game, How Washington Works. Clinton obviously learned a lot from him. His latest book, Who Stole the American Dream, which came out in the fall of 2012, is an in-depth look at what went wrong in the United States over the last four decades. I could go on and on about his impressive credentials. He was for years a principal panelist on PBS's Washington Week in Review, as well as a special correspondent for Jim Lehrer's The NewsHour. But you all know who he is. The topic, Reclaiming the American Dream. Rick.
Thanks very much, Max. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much, Max. It's a pleasure to be here back in Maine again. Maine is a spot that my wife and I, my kids and I, have visited many times. Mount Desert, various different places in Maine where I've spoken, university and so forth. So it's a pleasure to be back and to feel at home walking around the streets in Camden and to be with you. Tom promised me a really first-rate audience today, and I have to say I'm not entirely certain about it, because what Alvin Barkley said was a first-rate audience is highly intelligent, well-educated, a little bit drunk. And it seemed that would have fit the audience last night, but it's a little early for that today. I'm actually going to be a bit more optimistic, although you won't feel that during the first parts of my talk, than some of your prospective speakers, I gather, later this spring. I wanted to talk to you this morning, if I may, about the election, and with the backdrop that you can't deal with the world unless you can sort out your situation at home, unless we can actually make the government work at home. Because one of the problems we have dealing with the Middle East or the Russians or the Chinese is, or the Iranians, when you have members of the Senate sending a letter to a foreign government saying, don't sign a deal with our president because the next president may be from our party and we won't honor the agreement, which is a rather odd way to go, at least by my 50 years of reporting in Washington. So unless we can get this thing fixed at home, we're not going to have much of a foreign policy at all. And I want to look at the American election. But not in terms of the horse race, not in terms of the delegate count or the convention scenarios and so forth. I want to look at the election as an MRI on America. What does the election tell us about our country today? Because this is a very different kind of election than we normally have. It's not just different because Donald Trump's an unconventional candidate. It is different because the axis of the election is 90 degrees off the normal axis of an election. We mostly have elections that are left-right, Republican, Democrat, conservative, liberal, on a kind of a horizontal plane, if you will, on a graph. This one switched. This is an up-down election. It's a bottom-up election. What we're watching today in both political parties is a mutiny by the middle class against the elite. It's very interesting and very important time. It tells us something very fundamental about our country, and it's not going to be resolved by the outcome of the election. This is a state that we're in, and we're going to have to work our way out of it over a period of time. It's going to have enormous impact on foreign policy as well as on domestic policy. What do I mean by up-down? If you look at what Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump are doing, they're activating and connecting with a very deeply disenchanted American middle class. Probably most people in this room consider themselves middle class. 90% of Americans, if you ask them what they are, they will tell you they're middle class. I'm talking about the working middle class. I'm talking about families whose household income is somewhere between $30,000 and $100,000 a year, but basically clustered around $40,000 to $70,000 a year. This is a deeply unhappy cut of our society, and we're talking about 180 million people. More than half of our society falls in that fairly narrow salary belt, okay? These are people who feel dispossessed by globalization, dispossessed by our economy, dispossessed by our foreign trade deals, dispossessed by globalization, by modernization, by technology. They feel economically insecure to a degree that we, if looking around this room, you all may not be exactly the same age as I am, but judging by the amount of white hair, our experience was really quite different when we were in our 20s and our 30s from the experience of people in their 20s and 30s today. We're a deeply, deeply divided country. We're divided by money, we're divided by power, and we're divided by whom we trust. Think about it. Think what's happened in the Republican Party this year. It isn't just Donald Trump's cleverness with the media and defeat of a string of candidates. It is the loss of credibility by several fairly well-established office holders, senators, governors from New Jersey, Louisiana, Florida, Texas, Ohio, places where you would assume they would come into the race with a certain amount of weight, credibility, and momentum. And here's an entirely different kind of character, and he's outdistanced all of them. It isn't just because of Trump and because of the way the media has built up Trump. It is because the establishment politicians have lost credibility with the middle class in America. People think the system is rigged. They think the economic system is rigged. They think the political system is rigged. And they're prepared to overlook all kinds of other shortcomings to make that protest count in terms of votes. And if you look at what Bernie Sanders is doing on the other side, the same thing is going on. He's connected a lot with young people, of course, but he's connected with a lot of middle-class people who think the system is rigged. So here you have it in both political parties. The bottom and the middle are turning against the top. And you look at Hillary Clinton, whatever you think of her, wherever you stand, I'm trying to analyze this in a nonpartisan way, whatever you think of her, she's lost credibility because of her connections with Wall Street and with the political and the corporate elite. If you look at the unfavorability ratings that she has, it's a measure of the loss of credibility she has. So you have this going on in both parties. And then you look at what's going on in Washington, and Washington doesn't work. We can't solve immigration. We can't solve the budget crisis and dealing with Medicare and Social Security, if you're worried about that. We can't really deal with climate change. We can't deal with health care. We're having a terrible time dealing with healthcare. We're constantly going back and refighting the fight we thought we'd settled back in 2010. We have a system that, it reminds me of one of my favorite cartoons. It's that old Peanuts cartoon where Lucy has set up a card table in the backyard and it says psychiatry 1 cent. Well, you know who walks up? Charlie Brown walks up, puts down his penny. She says, "Charlie, before I can give you any therapy, before I can give you any advice, I need to have you think of life as a voyage on a great ocean liner. Now, there's some people and they take their deck chairs to the bow and they look into the future to see where they're going. And there are other people and they take their deck chairs to the stern and they look back to see where they've come from. Which group do you belong to?" Charlie scratched his head and thought for a moment. He said, "Lucy, I'm having trouble getting my chair unfolded." So that's our picture of Washington, right? They can't get their chair unfolded. Absolutely. And we laugh, but it's not funny. It's not funny, it's serious. And what my colleagues in the media tend to focus on is opinion polls that record the low status of the president or the low status of the Republican Party or the low status of Congress or the low status of the media, because we're right down there with them. And lawyers are too, and priests and a whole lot of other people who theoretically represent authority and something you should believe in. But the most important poll numbers to pay attention to, I believe, are the numbers that show that confidence in our political system as a system is at the lowest point in 40 years. I saw one poll that said 60% of the American people believe the United States is in decline. 60%, 3/5. I saw another poll that said 63%. Now, we're not talking about this party. We're not talking about this candidate. We're talking about this country. This is where people are. John Gardner, who was a Republican, moderate Republican, who helped, who worked in Lyndon Johnson's cabinet and then founded Common Cause, said in the late 90s, which is before, 20, you know, it's almost 20 years ago, before we got in the real mess of this century and the collapse of 2008, we are treading the edge of a precipice here. Civilizations die of disenchantment. If enough people lose faith in their society, the whole thing begins to fall apart. Now, judging by how quiet this room is at this moment, I have a sense that what I just said resonates with you, and that's important. Because if you're thoughtful, you understand that the stakes of the dilemma and the morass that we're in is far, far greater than the outcome of the next election. Far, far greater even than who's going to pick the next Supreme Court justice, who's going to control the Senate. Those things are important. But the problem we're in is much deeper. And unless we resolve it, we are, in fact, headed downhill. After I left Williams College, I went to Oxford. And at Oxford, one of the people I studied was Arnold Toynbee, the great British historian who wrote a 12-volume history of human civilization, 21 civilizations over 6,000 years. I want to admit right now I did not read all 12 volumes. I read a 2-volume abridgment by Somerville. Each of those 2 volumes is 1,200 pages long, so it was a chunk of reading. And what's interesting, it seems to me, and relevant to us, about what Toynbee wrote about human civilizations was his analysis of them in terms of how they survived and prevailed or why they went into decline and disappeared. And he does that in terms of challenge and response. Every civilization faces a challenge or a series of challenges, and it either responds effectively or it doesn't. And that determines its long-term fate. And he goes way back. He goes back to the Inca civilization in Latin America and the Egyptian civilization along the Nile. And he says, interesting to me, that their challenge was a challenge of a hostile environment. The question was, could they establish an effective agricultural economy that would sustain enough people that you could actually build a civilization? Well, we know they did that. We have the temples at Machu Picchu that are magnificent, and they still stand today, and we have the temples up and down the Nile and the pyramids and so forth. So we know they did that. But they fell victim to another challenge, the challenge of a power of an outside military invader with greater military power. In the case of the Incas, it was the Spaniards, and in the case of the Egyptians, it was the Ottoman Turks of the Ottoman Empire. That's a challenge we know something about. We know how to deal with an external enemy that tries to muster the military might to take us on. Okay? We did it with Hitler in World War II. And we did it with Stalin and the other leaders of the Soviet Union during the 50 years of the Cold War. But the two civilizations that we admire the most, ancient Greece and ancient Rome, fell victim to another kind of challenge. Toynbee calls that schisms in the soul of the society, schisms in the body politic. He actually calls it the body social, but we would call it the body politic. Schisms, internal divisions, eventually dragged down the Greek city-states and dragged down ancient Rome. And I would contend that what we face today are schisms in the soul of our society, and that is what threatens our ability to endure as a civilization. As I said before, we're divided. We're divided by money, by power, by whom we trust. and lots of other things. But in those divisions, I think, are even more important than the divisions of right-left, Republican-Democrat. And I think this year's election underlines that. Question, how do we get into this predicament? And what do we do about it? Well, I remember when I grew up, and when I went through my 20s and 30s, back in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s, we had divisions in our society, and we had political battles, but essentially more people felt included in the economic prosperity of the country. More people felt secure than feel secure today. And the political system worked. Yes, the Democrats and the Republicans fought like crazy over control of the White House or the Senate or what have you. But when they were done, they actually passed legislation and they went to conference committees and they actually passed bills. I mean, Dwight Eisenhower built the whole national highway system. Jack Kennedy sent us on a mission to the moon. We got to the moon. We passed Medicare and Medicaid, and we passed the Civil Rights Act. We passed all kinds of budgets, and we got all kinds of things done in terms of our ability to compete with the war. We competed in the Cold War, and we did it effectively. Politics literally at one point ended at the water's edge, as Senator Vandenberg of Michigan said at one point. So we had something that worked effectively. Now the question is, do we do that in the economy? And once we get to be white-haired, we have to be rather careful, I think, I certainly do, to say, well, you know, back when I was a young fellow, things really worked well. Or as Lyndon Johnson would say, boy, if you just go back and do it the way we did it when I was a boy, you'll be just all right, all right? I think we got a little bit skeptical. So I went back and checked the record just to see. From 1945 through the end of the 70s, the productivity of the American workforce roughly doubled. It went up 97%. And the median hourly pay and benefits of the typical worker in America went up 95%. 97 and 95. The growth of the economy, the profits of the great corporations, the efficiency of the American workforce and the economy got passed through to the people in the middle. Economists divide us up into quintiles, top 20%, second 20%, on down to the bottom 20%. And all five of those quintiles, the average household income went up over those that 30, 35-year period. And in fact, they went up a little faster in the bottom two quintiles than the top. I'm not suggesting we had or should have economic inequality, but with Charlie Wilson, who ran the largest corporation in the world, General Motors, he made about 35 or 40 times as much as his average worker did in a General Motors automobile plant. They were within shouting distance of each other. Today, the Standard & Poor's CEO makes about 300 times as much as the average worker. Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple, a few years ago took home $139 million. He made 4,233 times as much as the average Apple worker. And if you've ever been in an Apple store, the average Apple worker is not a blue-collar worker. That's a college graduate who's very sharp on computer skills, particularly software skills, and they can tell you how to work your computer, how to hook it up, do the kind of thing Nick did for me today in this room, help you work your cell phone, all that kind of. These are bright kids. And this guy's making 4,000 times as much as that? That's not how the economy worked back in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. Interesting. So how do they do it? How do they do it? Two things matter. Ideas and power. And when you're studying history, in fact, when you're looking at other countries, two things matter, ideas and power. Ideas, culture, when you're talking about other countries. How do other people's cultures work? And how does our culture work relating to theirs? But just in terms of domestic ideas and power. The idea that was important at that point was an idea that some economists call stakeholder capitalism. It was the idea that the CEO had the obligation and the responsibility, some said even the moral responsibility, some said the sacred duty, to balance the economic interests of all the stakeholders in the corporation, that is, all the people who had a stake in the survival and success of the corporation. Obviously, that meant the shareholders, and it meant the managers, but it also meant the workers, it meant the suppliers, it meant the bankers that gave them credit, it meant the people who bought their products. You don't want to buy a car or a cell phone and have the company go out of business, they can't even service your product. You have a stake in the survival once you buy their product of that company, in that company. And it certainly meant the communities in which they operated, many of which, if you go around America today, have been devastated. We lost 56,000 industrial facilities in the decade between 2000 and 2010. 56,000 plants or industrial facilities shut down in one decade. Can you imagine how devastating that is to the tax base, to the ability to fund education, to fund healthcare, to fund roads in all those communities and all those states? Devastating. So they definitely have a stake in the survival of the corporations. And it's amazing to go back and read what Charlie Wilson said, or Reg Jones, who was the CEO of General Electric, or Remington at Coca-Cola, or Irving Shapiro at DuPont. I could go on down the list. I went back and I read them. And they actually say, it's smart economics and smart business to share the wealth. If you pay, economists call this the virtuous circle of growth, if you pay tens of millions of middle-class Americans a decent salary with benefits, with healthcare benefits and retirement benefits, they're going to go out and spend, in good times, 95% of that money, and in bad times, 105% of that money, okay? The debt went up a lot for lots of people after the collapse of 2008. So the idea was, if you pay that people that well, they're going to generate enormous demand, and that's going to push production to expand, hire more people, build more plants, buy more new equipment, invent new things. And that's what powered the great American surge from the 40s through the 70s. And it breaks down when you begin to have that idea change. I'll tell you about that in a minute. The second thing that mattered, and this is the subject I really want to talk to you about today, is power. If you go back and look at that period, it was a period of exercise of power actively by the American middle class. My first exposure to it as a reporter was in 1960 in Nashville, Tennessee, with the beginning of the Civil Rights Movement, the sit-ins. I met John Lewis there, met Martin Luther King in Albany, Georgia, a year or so later, the Freedom Riders, the buses, and then the Birmingham. I was there in Birmingham with the police dogs and all that, March on Washington, I Have a Dream speech, and so forth. This was an enormous expansion of the idea of American democracy. This was a protest movement, but it was a movement that was optimistic. America can do better. Martin Luther King was calling us to live up to our best ideals, to our best selves, to the promises of our great institutions, the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. But there was a women's movement too. Betty Friedan wrote The Femme Mystique 51 years ago. Jack Kennedy, 2 years later, signed the first anti-gender discrimination legislation ever passed in the history of the United States. There was a consumer's movement. Ralph Nader wrote Unsafe at Any Speed, saying the Detroit car manufacturers were making cars with defects that were causing accidents that were killing people. Does that sound at all familiar to you? I mean, we're in the same mess today. Okay, but there was a consumer's movement where people started to say, wait a second, we want products properly labeled. We want them weighed. We want to know what the contents are. We don't want to limit capitalism. We just simply want to make the transaction open and honest. And if you go into a grocery store or a drugstore, any store today, and you pick up a product and you're tempted to turn it over to look what's in on the back of it, do you want to put it in your mouth? Do you want to put it on your face? Do you want to feed it to your family? You can thank those people in the 1960s and 70s for doing those protests, because that's what got the legislation on the books that required the labeling of packages that you have today. It improved the performance of the Agriculture Department inspecting meat, the Food and Drug Administration on drugs and so forth. And these were protests. People went in the streets. You live in this absolutely gorgeous state of Maine with this wonderful greenery up here and this great nature. What is the day? Today is May 16th. Just less than a month ago, we had Earth Day, April 22nd. Remember anything about Earth Day this last April 22nd? I didn't hear much about Earth Day at all. Earth Day 1970, 20 million Americans went into the streets. 20 million Americans went into the streets, went to college campuses, went to the mall in Washington, went to state capitals, went to radio stations and television stations and had talkathons and so on. I mean, everybody was involved. Clean up the air, clean up the water. Within 1 year, within 12 months, Congress passed 7 major pieces of environmental legislation. The Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Safe Drinking Water Act, the Anti-Toxic Substance Act, on and on and on. All but one signed by that great environmentalist, Richard Nixon. Okay, Nixon was a pro-business Republican president. He appointed Bill Ruckelshaus, the first head of the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, which Nixon founded by executive order. I know Bill Ruckelshaus well. He's a friend of mine. I said, Bill, did I miss something? Was Nixon a closet greenie? He said, that is a funny idea. He said, no. He said, you know, never once when I went in to see him and talked to him, did he ever say, Bill, is it really dirty out there? Is it true that if you put your arm in the Potomac River and you bring it out, it's covered with green slime from the algae caused by the phosphorus and nitrogen pollution in the Potomac River and the Chesapeake Bay? He said, no. He said, one thing I remember he said to me, he says, when you get over there, he said, don't let the bureaucrats at EPA capture you. EPA. Nixon was the only person in Washington who thought the acronym for the EPA, which he had founded, was EPA. That's how connected he was with the EPA, right? So I said to Bill, I said, so why did he do it? Why did he sign all that legislation? He said, the people demanded it. People were demonstrating, and the legislation was whipping through Congress with 87 to 5, 93 to 2. I mean, the bipartisan votes were just enormous. When you look at Congress today, you won't believe you could get the bipartisan votes you got for that, okay? So he said, you know, people spoke, we in government had to respond, that's the way democracy is supposed to work. I said that fast, but think about it. The people spoke, we in government have to respond, that's the way democracy is supposed to work. I learned that in high school. Didn't we learn that in high school? It's way off the track from that now, right? So the point was there were those syllogisms, there were those dynamisms at work. That was the power at work that people were exercising. And there was this idea that we had a society in which we had shared interests. And they weren't just related to the issues I mentioned. People wanted the tops of the mountains and the economy cut off, and they wanted the floor lifted. Every 3 or 4 years, the minimum wage was raised with strong bipartisan votes, not as big as the environmental votes, but 70 votes or more, not slim majorities, okay? The tax rate, do you know what the tax rate was under Dwight Eisenhower? 92%? 92% marginal tax rate. We're told today if we raised it above 40%, the economy would come to a dead halt. Not true. It was dropped to 77% under Kennedy, the Democrat, in the 1960s. The growth rate, you should know, for the 1950s and the 60s, those two decades, ups and downs in the economy, poverty, all kinds of problems, okay, nothing perfect, but the growth rate averaged between 3 and 3.1%. And when we get down to the tax rate of 35% under Republican George W. Bush and Democrat Barack Obama, the growth rate has been 1%. A little bit over 1%, including the period before the collapse of 2008. There is no connection in the track record of American history between the marginal tax rate on personal taxes and the national growth rate, okay? So people wanted that. People pushed for that. Public power had an impact on public policy. Ideas and power, and they both changed. What the stakeholder capitalism got replaced by was the idea of shareholder capitalism. Milton Friedman put it into words in a book called Capitalism Freedom in 1961. Friedman said there's only one mission of a CEO, and that is to maximize return to shareholders. Shareholder capitalism. You have heard this thousands of times on MSNBC, on whatever station you listen to. Maximum return to shareholders, that's our job as CEOs. Okay? Disastrous idea. Disastrous idea. In fact, some of the best CEOs in America have said that in recent years, although they practiced it when they were in office. They had to retire first to understand what was going on or to tell us the truth. Jack Welch among them, but lots of others as well. And what that did was it led to an enormous inequality of wealth. If you look at the productivity of the American workforce from 1979 to about 2012 or 2013, it rises about 80%. If you look at the hourly pay and benefits of the typical worker, it rises about 10%, and mainly because more women went to work. Okay, 80% and 10% versus 97 and 95, huge difference. From 1979 to 2012 or 2013, Alan Krueger, an economist from Princeton, and Emmanuel Sayers, and another economist from UC Berkeley, studied American income tax returns and reported 84% of the nation's entire growth in income between the late 70s and the teens of this century, 84% went to the top 1%. Now think about that. When I first heard the slogan, the 99% and the 1% from Occupy Wall Street, I thought that is a clever bumper sticker slogan. 99 versus 1, everybody wants to be on the side of the 99. But that's obviously an economic distortion that has been compressed in a clever bumper sticker slogan. But if you think about Kruger's numbers, if the top 1% got 84%, that means the rest of us, unless you're 1%, the rest of us got 16%. And 84 is 5 times as much as 16, right? It means the top 1% got the top 3 million people in this country, in those households, got 5 times as much as the growth of the nation's economy over 3 decades as the other 300 million Americans. Now do you understand why this election is the way it is? Why it's a bottom-up election? This has been coming for a long time. We're just getting into it, and we're going to have to deal with it. We have to deal with it. We're not going to wind up by dealing with it effectively after this election. It's going to take us a decade or more, but we got to go to work on it, seriously. Or this country is going to do what John Gardner said and what Toynbee has said about civilizations that collapse. That's what I believe. And I think we got to take it seriously. The other problem was power changed. Power changed dramatically. The middle class, in some ways, was too successful in the exercise of power. And the assumption was, oh, we won all these pieces of legislation in the environment. The EPA will take care of it. We've begun to get legislation that's going to help women. They'll take care of it. We finally had a Supreme Court about discrimination and segregation. That'll take care of it. And we don't have to be so active anymore. That's the first thing that happened. But the other thing that happened is really interesting. And I have to admit, having been the Washington bureau chief of the New York Times in the late 70s and early 80s, I saw the symptoms of what I'm about to describe to you, but I had no idea what the cause was, nor did any of the 65 people who worked for me in the New York Times bureau, and nor do many American journalists today. What happened was a revolt of the bosses. What happened was a revolt from above. We always think of revolutions as occurring from the bottom up, but they can occur from the top down as well. There was a guy named Lewis Powell, who was a famous corporate attorney, who came from Richmond, Virginia, was president of the American Bar Association at one point, very close to people at the US Chamber of Commerce. And Powell was a great believer in the American free enterprise system, a great foe of organized labor. But he also became a foe of the women's movement, the environment movement, all these other movements I've been talking about, because he felt they were limiting the flexibility, limiting the power, limiting the growth, and slowly choking off private enterprise. He actually saw the labor movement. He said Walter Ruther, who was the president of the United Auto Workers Union, was a greater threat to American free enterprise than Soviet communism at one point. His friends in the US Chamber of Commerce said, you know, you've made this argument to us. Why don't you write it down in brief? He wrote a paper, which is, I believe, the most important neglected document in American history in the last 50 years. I got my publisher to put the text of it in the back of my book, Who Stole the American Dream? It's Powell's memo written in August of 1971, and it is a clarion call. He's a Paul Revere. He's issued a manifesto to corporate America, and he says, you are crazy. You're doing well in the economy, but you're getting killed in the political arena. You've got to get active. You got to go get involved. You got to go take the high ground. You got to start contributing and forming political action committees. You got to start going after your enemies aggressively. You got to develop a long-term political plan. You've got to move offices to Washington. You got to start lobbying the government in a vigorous way. And you got to start going after your foes on the campuses, in the women's movement, in the environmental movement, in the labor movement, and so forth. He lays it all out there. And believe it or not, that's what happened. Not because Powell was so significant and influential as an individual, though he was a pretty good spokesman, but because business leaders were actually feeling as crowded as Powell said they were. And suddenly, his seeds fell on very fertile earth. They heard his message. Within 4 months of Powell's memo being secretly circulated by the US Chamber of Commerce, the Business Roundtable was formed. If you follow American politics, you know the Business Roundtable is the single most influential voice of blue-chip corporate America in Washington today. It did not exist prior to his memo. At the time Powell wrote his memo, there were 175 companies, only 175 companies that even had offices in Washington. Within 8 years before Reagan gets elected, there are 2,425 companies that have offices in Washington. There are 9,000 registered corporate lobbyists by 1980. There are 50,000 people working for corporate business trade associations. There is a veritable political army of lobbyists. And guess what? They hit and they start to affect the change in American policy and the allocation of economic resources in America, not with Ronald Reagan, as I thought and most of the rest of us thought, but actually when the Democrats were controlling Congress and when Jimmy Carter was in the White House. The most pivotal year in American economic policy was 1978. Reagan was elected in 1980. It's really astonishing to see this. When I went back and looked at it, I said, oh my God. We saw these things happening bit by bit. We didn't realize what was going on. 1978 is the first year the corporate tax rate is lowered, only by 2%, but previously it had been raised. It's the first time it went in the other direction. It's the first time the capital gains tax is lowered. It's the biggest capital gains tax reduction in the last half century. It goes from 48% to 28%. Now, the capital gains tax benefits anybody who invests, but you need to know that economists have now studied this. At least 50%, if not more, of the capital gains tax benefit goes to the top 1%. We shouldn't be surprised by that. Okay? So it's heavily benefited people at the top. Carter tried to index the minimum wage to the rising cost of inflation. He failed. He did get an increase in the minimum wage while he was president, but there wasn't any for the next decade, and that began to change. And under Reagan, of course, the tax rates came down. I'll get to that in a minute. But the most important change, well, the two important changes that played out over the years. The corporate bankruptcy law was changed in a fundamental way that advantaged management and disadvantaged the unions. And that means the pay and benefits of millions of workers. And the second thing that got passed in 1978 was the 401k plan. Now, the 401k plan was never intended as a national retirement plan. It was actually a tax deferral scheme for profit sharing for executives at Kodak and Xerox and about a half a dozen New York banks. Think about it. If you had a national plan, would you call it 401k? It's called 401k because it's paragraph 401 in the US tax code and it's subparagraph K. It was designed not to be noticed. That's how it got passed. It got converted later on by the Reagan administration and by the mutual fund industry. There may be some mutual fund executives in the room here. You'll remember this, that the mutual fund industry said, oh my God, we could get control and we could earn enormous amounts of money if we could convince people they can manage their own retirement funds, which by the way has been a disaster for most people. Some people do it well, maybe they're all the people sitting in this room, but the average American is terrible at it. We now have a $6 trillion retirement shortfall partly because people have been so bad at running their 401k plans. It's a disastrous plan for the nation as a whole. All that got passed because Powell's army was pushing the Democratic Congress, some of whose members got elected in the post-Watergate period in Republican districts, and they were very worried about getting defeated. The direction of American policy changed. Under Reagan, it gets much more accelerated. Tax cuts under Reagan have added $1 trillion to the wealth of the top 1% every decade. A trillion in the 80s, a trillion in the 90s, a trillion in the 2000s, and the Bush tax cuts added another trillion. So $4 trillion. So you have these two things working together. Minimum wage gets frozen, tax rates come down, and the tax cuts are benefiting the top. And within the private sector, you've got inequality growing because of the way the policies that are promoted by shareholder capitalism, which I don't have time to go into, but if you want to, we can do that in the question period. Question, can we do anything about it now? Is anything being done about it now? And the answer is yes. And that's where I'm positive. And I hope I've got enough time to talk about that just a little bit. People have come to understand in this country, you understand it here in Maine. You have a public funding system for your political campaigns in Maine. I understand a bit of a problem with the governor, whether or not he's going to release the money. But you do at least have a system, and maybe you can go to court or whatever again. Lots of states don't have that. Connecticut has it, Minnesota has it, Arizona has it, but you guys in that sense are a model. There are now 29 states that have a higher minimum wage than the federal minimum wage. And I understand that in this state it is now an issue again, and you may decide to go higher than you are. You're a little bit above the federal. So 29 states have decided if Washington is stuck, we're moving ahead. And these include red states. In the last election, there were four states that elected Republican senators and simultaneously raise the minimum wage. And somebody came up with the idea of whether or not corporations have to deliver maximum return. CEOs are legally obliged. Are they legally obliged to deliver maximum return to their shareholders? And there's a lot of argument about this. I think the answer is no. But there are a lot of general counsels of major corporations that persuade their CEOs, it may not be too hard a pitch, that they have to do this. So somebody came up with the idea of having an incorporation for a public benefit corporation. That is a corporation that can pursue other aims than maximum return to shareholders, protecting the environment, educating and paying their workers more, protecting community interests, contributing to community interests. In 2010, there was no state that had a public benefit law. Today, there are 27 states. In 6 years, 27 states have published public benefit corporation laws, and there are now over 1,100 registered corporations that are public benefit corporations, and they've just begun to move to Wall Street to float their IPOs, their investment options for people. So those things are moving in the economy. There are other things going on. There are states that are now tackling student debt, which is an enormous problem, taking an initiative that Washington has not been able to take or been willing to take because it's stuck in partisan gridlock. On the reform area, you've got public funding here. I mentioned that. There are now 16 states and more than 700 communities that have passed resolutions calling for the rollback of Citizens United and restoring the power of Congress and the states to regulate campaign finance. Right, that's all happened in the last since Citizens United 2010, which unleashed the Niagara of corporate funding. So that's moving. States have now stepped up the disclosure of dark money. Dark money, money we can't trace, anonymous money going to political candidates, amounted to about $5 million in 2006. That's a decade ago. In 2012, they hit $302 million. They're already, it's going to go well over $500 million this year. I mean, it is skyrocketing. Why? Because there are lots of corporations. If you're running American Express, if you're running Coca-Cola, if you're running a consumer product company, you may not want your customers to know which candidate you're backing. Because part of your audience, maybe more than half of your audience, may not like you're backing certain political candidates. So being able to donate secretly is really helpful. And it's really helpful for us as voters to know who's donating. I mean, think of the race not too far from you between Elizabeth Warren and Scott Brown. And Scott Brown was saying, as a Republican senator for those 2 years that he was filling out Teddy Kennedy's term in the Senate, he was really tough on the Wall Street banks. Now, if you drill down and you looked at what he did, he actually wrote a loophole into the financial regulatory law that benefited the banks greatly. And then he voted for the law and said, see, I voted for the law to regulate the banks. But what really told you where Scott Brown was campaign donations. Massachusetts has a tough law on campaign disclosure. And before the end of the campaign, Massachusetts voters knew that Wall Street banks had pumped something like $15 million into Scott Brown's campaign, which told you more about where Scott Brown was going to be after the election than anything he or Elizabeth Warren said during the election. So knowing where money is coming from and to whom and from whom is really an important indicator for voters. So we're moving on that front. I've got this website that's up here. Was up here. ReclaimTheAmericanDream.org. I did it because I'm a journalist, and when I looked at the mainstream media, what I found out was that mainstream media was doing nothing on the issues I'm talking about. They'd cover a story here or there, but they wouldn't put it together. You can go on this website, and I hope we'll do that in the question period, but I won't take much time with it now. But you can find out today, gerrymandering is one of the principal problems for gridlock in Washington. Money is one big problem, and gerrymandering, and together, they're an enormous problem. We have roughly 90% of the congressional districts in the House are so gerrymandered, they're political monopolies. Today, a good reporter can tell you how the House is going to come out, with the exception of about 30 or 40 seats this fall, because of gerrymandering. If we want to break the gridlock in Washington, we've got to break the gridlock of gerrymandering. You don't have that many congressional districts in the state, so it's probably not a problem for you at that level. But at the legislative level, it might be. And then other states are saying, wait a second. We now have more independent voters in America than we do registered Republicans or registered Democrats. If you have party primaries, independents can't vote. In this significant election, and in 90% of the congressional districts, the primary is the main deciding point in the whole campaign. In Massachusetts, the Democrats run the show. 62% of the voters in Massachusetts are either Republicans or independents. They have no voice on the selection of state legislators, except in a few districts, and none in congressional districts. In Massachusetts and Connecticut combined, there are 15 congressional seats. Those two states are run by Democrats. Roughly a third of the votes in every election, between 30 and 38% in every election, are Republican. Guess how many seats they get in Congress? Zero. They should get 5. The Democrats should get 10. I mean, just looking at the outcome of the election. In the 2012 election, more people voted for Democratic candidates nationwide. 1.5 million more people voted for Democrats nationwide than voted for Republicans, and the Republicans came out with a 33-vote majority in the House. Gerrymandering. Gerrymandering did it in Pennsylvania, in North Carolina, in Wisconsin, in Michigan. All those states had more Democratic votes than Republicans. In Pennsylvania, Republicans got 13 seats, Democrats got 5. In North Carolina, Republicans got 9 seats, Democrats got 4. In Michigan, 11-5. I mean, absolutely distorting the popular vote, totally distorting the popular vote. And we sit here saying, well, we got to elect the right president, and that president's going to wave a magic wand, and the thing's going to fix. No, ladies and gentlemen, it's not. We're going to keep going on this path that Toynbee and Gardner are talking about, unless we take seriously that, in fact, our political system is broken. It needs structural fixes, and the only people who can and will fix it are people sitting in this room and rooms like this all over America. We have to do it. The slogan on my website is, see if I can get there. Okay, it's up to us. It's up to us. We have to do it. Washington's not going to do it. The politicians who are there like the system the way it is. Actually, they don't. They hate the system the way it is, but they survive. There are now 140 former governors, senators, members of Congress on record from both parties from 43 different states who want political reforms. Guess what? They only want them when they get out of office. They're only honest enough about it when they get out of office and they say, it's crazy. We're spending more than half of our time raising money. Do you know how many days they're in Washington? They are in Washington from Tuesday to Thursday. They're at home from Friday to Monday. And when they're in Washington from Tuesday to Thursday, half of those days, at least half of those days, are spent raising money. Do you think they can do the people's business in a day and a half? Would you hire somebody to work for you and pay them a week's salary if they're going to work for you for a day and a half? Would you? I wouldn't. It's crazy. But we have to understand how fundamental this problem is and how it's connected with the inequality of income and how all the money that has now been piled up at the top is now coming in. I mean, hedge fund managers are throwing $10 million every quarter into the political campaigns. And we're sitting there saying, you know, this is terrible. We should do something about it. Yes, we should make up our minds today that we're going to go back to what people did in the 60s and 70s. We're going to get out. We're going to march. We're not going to get on the internet and send a Twitter. I don't suspect this crowd does a lot of tweeting, but we're not going to sign a petition. We're going to insist today, if the damn money isn't coming for public funding, then why aren't there 300 people at the state capitol saying to the governor, this is the law of this state, you must do it. We got to make it uncomfortable. I'm not picking on him as a personality, but when politicians are not doing what we the people have gotten done, and what's been voted into law, then we have got to engage. It's not about talking. It's not about saying they've got to fix it. As long as the pronoun in our sentence about the problems in America is a third-person pronoun, the problems aren't going to change. It has to be we and us. Thank you.
That's a terrific, inspiring talk, Rick.
Thank you.
That was great. here's a first question. We got a whole bunch of them, and we haven't got a lot of time, but we'll do what we can. How much do you think the assassination of Martin Luther King and the two Kennedys affected power and the economy in the United States? Do you think that had an impact at that point?
I don't want to give you the answer I'm going to give you because I don't want to diminish the horror of those two episodes, but I don't think those were fundamental. I don't think those had a fundamental impact. I really do think the forces we're talking about here are the ones I was talking about. Sure, they're affected at the time, and they're certainly affected at the moment and by people's emotions. But I think the changes are much more structural, much more fundamental, and they're built more deeply now into our culture, which we've got to turn around. By the way, we're told repeatedly, the inequality today is all a result of globalization and modernization and technology. If you look at Germany today, they face the same problems that globalization and modernization we do. Their middle class is much better off than ours is. We're told you can't do manufacturing anymore. This is what I mean about fundamental force. We can't do manufacturing anymore. That's over. In 1999, 19% of our workforce was in manufacturing. Today, it's about 8%. So in about 15 years, we've lost a huge chunk of manufacturing, very important for the health of our economy and extremely important for the economic forces of the middle class. Germany today still has 21% of its workforce in manufacturing, and you'd say, well, they obviously can't trade well in the world. They're the world's best trading company. They're the world's country. They're the world's best exporting company. In a decade when we had a $6 trillion trade deficit, 2000 to 2010, Germany had a $2 trillion trade surplus. So you can pursue those policies and be effective in world trade. I think it's those kind of fundamentals more than those assassinations that matter.
Okay, well, here's a question that kind of relates to your comments about Germany. Aren't most countries, most Western European industrialized countries, tending to die of disenchantment, the kind of thing you described in the United States? Are we uniquely bad off in this regard?
Well, in terms of inequality, we're off the charts compared to other countries. The economists have a thing called the Gini coefficient, which is designed to measure inequality. If you have a perfectly equal economy, you have a score of zero. And if you have Bill Gates or somebody owning everything, you have a one. So the higher your score, the worse off you are. Most European countries are at 0.23 to 0.35. We're close to 0.50. We're about 0.48. So we're way off the chart in terms of inequality. Are Europeans disenchanted today? Sure. I mean, look at the Greeks, look at the Spaniards, look at the Italians. They've got a particularly hard time at the moment. But I'm trying to talk about long-term trends. And by the moment, I mean the last 2 or 3 years and probably the next 2 or 3 years. But if you look over a period of time at Germany versus us, no, the disenchantment there is nothing like our disenchantment.
Given the great discontent of the masses, as you described, the 99%, could a Mussolini-like leader emerge in the United States?
Sure. That's a situation that is made for demagoguery. I mean, if you look at what happened to Weimar Germany, it was the failure of the economy and the failure of the political system which enabled Hitler to come to power. That doesn't mean I think we have a Hitler on the scene. It doesn't mean it's inevitable. But you certainly have... Well, Donald Trump's gotten 10 million votes in the primary so far. You certainly have a big chunk of those 10 million who are deeply disenchanted economically, and they can be misled into believing the fix is building a wall on the Mexican border. That's the kind of terribly counterproductive and dangerous policy that you can get into when people are this desperate.
How much blame, this is a good one for you to answer, Rick. How much blame does today's media have for not focusing on these issues? How do you see the New York Times' role in covering these economic issues?
Well, there's no question we have a lot of responsibility for not informing people well in the media. Basically, I don't think, including myself, I don't think that we covered the story of the growing inequality in America, except episodically. This factory closed down. This community is in trouble. These were dots. We were not connecting the dots. Until Occupy. Before Occupy put 99% and 1% into the public dialogue, which is the shorthand for inequality, The media basically didn't deal with it as a systemic problem. We dealt with it as separate stories. That's what I'm saying about political reform today. The media will report there's a gerrymander bill in Florida and there's a public funding bill in Maine, but it gets lost because nobody's pulling it together and telling you that there are trends that are happening. We blew it, no question.
Is there enough meaningful work that will pay enough to change what's become this structural inequality as a result of technological innovation? In other words, the loss of jobs.
Yeah. Well, we don't know because we haven't tried in any systemic way. But one thing we certainly could do that has been recommended by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the American Federation of Labor, John Kerry, Kay Bailey Hutchinson, I'm deliberately picking political opposites, and that is to fix our national infrastructure. If you've been to Japan or China, you know how far behind we are. I first went to Shenzhen, which is right across Kowloon Bay from Hong Kong in 1994. There was no modern port of Shenzhen there. I went back there a decade later. It was in 10 years, it was the fourth largest port in the world. And today it is now the third busiest port in the world. I've been there. The technology of that port is just much more modern than Seattle, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Long Beach. Our ports on the West Coast, it's terrible. If you look at the high-speed trains in Japan, if you ride the Shinkansen, you can go 200 miles an hour and your water glass barely wiggles. And when I ride Amtrak from Washington to New York, I can barely type on my computer. I've got so many typos because I'm lurching all the time. And that's me, but it's affecting all kinds of good. We could probably spend somewhere between $5 and $10 trillion modernizing our infrastructure all over the country, ports, airports, roads, highways, railroads, and so forth. And I can go into detail about this and generate jobs for the people who are doing the construction and generate jobs for the people who are making the steel and making the computerized equipment, all that kind of stuff. And we could improve job prospects for young people, and we could make America much more competitive. And a lot of companies that are now struggling would then become competitive because of our investment there. So yeah, there's a lot we can do. I didn't want to get into solutions in my book. And my editor told me, you got to do it, Kate Medina. And I said, I'm a reporter. I do balls and strikes. I tell you what the story is and let the chips fall away. She kept insisting. And my wife, Susan, finally said to me, Rick, you got to put solutions in your book. I now have a Hedrick Smith handy-dandy 10-point plan to save America. And I'm glad you're laughing because I'm uncomfortable with it. But I basically took ideas from other people. I'm not a policy wonk. And one of them was the infrastructure. But there's stuff we can do about the Chinese currency. They're just a whole R&D. We're losing on R&D. R&D used to be what kept America out front. You will not believe how we've lost the edge in R&D. This is coming not from me. This is coming from really good scientists, National Science Foundation, people like the U.S. Academy of Sciences. So there's lots we can do. I mean, saying we can't do anything is just betraying the fact that you haven't looked into it.
Yeah, well, this is kind of a follow-up, and it addresses exactly what you were talking about. Why can't we at least rebuild our infrastructure?
Well, basically because you've got an argument about whether or not the government should be involved in doing anything. Okay? Now, let's just take a look at American history. Samuel F.B. Morse invented the telegraph. He had a $30,000 appropriation from Congress. He then had another $10,000 appropriation for Congress to set up a line between New York and Washington and try it. Now we're told if government does something like that, they're picking winners and losers, and it's a disaster. Thank God we gave the money to Morse, right? The government gave the land grants and the money to build the Transcontinental Railroad under Abraham Lincoln, okay? The government spent the money under Dwight Eisenhower. I'm talking all Republican presidents here. Have you noticed this? Okay? We built the national highway system. It wouldn't exist. We wouldn't be able to send as much goods around this country and have the commerce that we have, let alone the leisure travel that we have without the highway system. I mean, the history of America is replete with times when the government has stepped in partnership with the private sector, which is, by the way, what the Germans do. Germans have very good partnership between management and labor and private and public sector. And we've got this notion that never the twain shall meet. We need to go back and study our own history and take a look at what's happened in the past. But we've got some people, and we actually have a group of about 40 Republicans in the House who simply will not let this legislation move, even if their own speaker wants to do it. And that's a product of gerrymandering. 38 out of those 40 people come from gerrymandered districts. So the political reforms, we're going to have to fix democracy first to get to the problems we're talking about in the economy.
Okay, well, this question sort of relates to the fact that you referred to earlier, that if you look around, we've got a lot of gray-haired people in this audience, which are not the ones that in the 70s were out there marching in the streets. So the question is, if every person in this audience shared your talk with their children.
You got it.
Okay.
You got it. I'm telling you, what we have in our generation, we have a memory, we have a resource that we can share with our kids and our grandchildren around the table. When you get together with Thanksgiving, yeah, we all want to talk about the football team and how Judy's doing and with her cello and how Freddie's doing, you know, playing soccer and all that kind of, but just a little time. One of my ideas about teaching civics in America is after the Pledge of Allegiance in schools, how about 5 minutes from kindergarten all the way through high school, 5 minutes every day, learning something about the name of the president, the name of your senator, the name of your mayor, what the city government does, what the federal government does, and you start out very simple, and 5 minutes a day. It doesn't take a lot, but it takes engagement. God damn it, it's a great idea to talk to your kids.
Thanks for whoever wrote that question. Do you think that a greater emphasis on state-level politics can be more effective than even bothering with Congress?
Absolutely. No question about it. What's happening in America today is happening in the states. And go back to American history. Think what happened. We've been here before, ladies and gentlemen. In the late 1880s and late 1890s, we had what was called the Gilded Age. We had the robber barons. We had a huge concentration of wealth. We had John D. Rockefeller. And we also simultaneously, most people don't remember this, depending upon how good your history teacher was, we had a thing called the Long Depression. Most of that 20-year period was depression. And average people were in terrible shape. What do we see at the beginning of the 20th century? The beginnings of the progressive era. We see the push for the women's vote. We see the push to get direct election of senators. Why? Because state legislatures in the period of the robber barons and the railroad barons were so corrupt. People said, we got to elect those people directly. And we got the income tax amendment. And then we have Teddy Roosevelt and trust busting. And do you know what happened? In 1907, 109 years ago, 103 years before the Citizens United decision, Congress passed the first law that banned corporate contributions to political campaigns. 1907. This stuff all started in the states and percolated into Washington. I hope, and I have just a tiny bit of hope, that we're actually in the beginning of a progressive era like that right now. It may not sound like that for the public benefit corporations, people tackling Tennessee, the governor of Tennessee, Republican state, Republican legislature, they passed a bill to fund free public education at community colleges in the state of Tennessee for anybody who finishes and gets a degree from a diploma from a Tennessee high school. Not a terribly big step, but a step you would never expect to happen in Tennessee. In Florida, they passed an unbelievable gerrymander reform at the same time they were electing a very conservative governor and a very conservative legislature. And it will have an gerrymander reform is now playing out in Florida. It will have an impact on at least 3 seats in the state of Florida this election. So these things are happening in America, yes, and they're happening at the state.
Two of our candidates are telling us society is broken, but it looks like the third candidate is going to win. Is that a step forward or a step back?
It's a step forward. It's a step forward. Think of this. Prior to this year, no one running for president that I can remember, this is not fair, no one in a major party, okay, because there probably were Greens and others, no presidential would-be contender from a major party has even suggested that political reform is necessary. We now have one candidate who has gone from beginning to the end, and that's his major theme. That's begun to change the debate. That's begun to change the expectations. He's engaged the younger generation. Look, I got asked 8 months ago or 6 months ago at a speech that I was giving in Seattle, Washington, by somebody who said, does Bernie have a chance to win? And I said, the media has got you asking the wrong question. The question is, does Bernie have ideas that we should be paying attention to and doing something about? That's what's happened. That's changed. And do you know what? In the process, Lindsey Graham, Republican senator from South Carolina, Jeb Bush, former Republican governor of Florida, have come out for a constitutional amendment to reverse Citizens United. So is it having an effect? Yes. I mean, Hillary Clinton has already moved well to the left on the issues of political reform than where she was before Bernie began. We have got to get used to the notion that everything, that the only things that count are winning and losing. Yeah, you got to win victories for reform. But is it a failure not to? In Florida, they failed 5 times to pass gerrymander reform, and they passed it on the 6th time. It's hanging in there that makes a difference. It's taken us 30, 35 years to get in this mess. It's going to take a while to get out. And people got to roll. You know, what was the title of that book? True Grit. We need a little true grit on the reformer side. We need to go beyond, you know, wishing for it, hoping for it, saying nice things to our friends and neighbors, saying, God damn it, we got to go up to Augusta and tell that governor to release that money. Sounds like I'm an agitator for that. But, you know, Martin Luther King, I kind of... How many more you got? I got a Martin Luther King story.
That's fine. I've got 25 more, but I've only got one that I'm going to have time to ask. Yeah.
All right. So do what you want.
No, go ahead.
No, I'll tell a story after that.
Okay. All right. This was the question we're going to end on because it's a little bit idealistic. Do you think, maybe your answer won't be, that most Americans, most middle-aged Americans today still believe in President Kennedy's challenge to ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country?
I think they would if they thought about it. And I think that Bernie is the first candidate who's actually asked us to think about it in about 20 years. So I think a lot of people are really busy raising their kids and worrying about buying a new home at that particular age group and so forth. But it's now out there. And there's no question that lots of people are engaged. In states around the country, and many, if you go to this website and explore, just go up and look for the. Let me take a moment here. You should know. These are success stories that we picked around the country. The little town of SeaTac passed a ballot measure. This is a blue-collar town with a whole lot of immigrants. They passed the first $15 minimum wage in the country. California passed one of the best dark money disclosure laws after a Koch network funneled $15 million into a ballot initiative fight in California. In Arizona, they've passed. They've had several votes, and they've had huge challenges that went all the way to the Supreme Court over gerrymander reform. In Colorado, 73% of the voters voted for a popular vote, amendment for the Constitution to roll back Citizens United, and it carried in every single county in the state, red states, red counties, blue counties, purple counties, all across the state. There was almost no difference between registered Republicans, Democrats, and independents, maybe a point or two difference. Maine, you've got in Connecticut, using public funding. You remember the great story about Market Basket and the whole battle over whether or not the portion of the family that owned the supermarket chain wanted to get more money out in dividends, and the guy wanted to pay more money to the workers and give consumers a better deal, and the consumer worker guy won out. It's a great story about saving American capitalism. Tennessee, I mentioned, taking out student debt. This is going on all over the country. Those are success stories. And we have progress reports on all these issues, a state-by-state rundown. You can go take a look at the map. I'm running one today on Facebook. There are 43 states, I think I mentioned it before, in which former members of Congress, former senators, former governors have now come out and said we need political reform. This is partly answering the earlier question, is it a failure? No. Politicians are starting, some are starting to come out. They're safe now that they're out of office. They can say it. When they're in office, they're afraid that their colleagues will accuse them of betraying the party, and party loyalty is more important than loyalty to the country. That's a serious problem that we have in our politics today. But the point is, this is happening. And you look at the states and you see them, and they're marked red and blue and purple, you'd be surprised at the states that are there. You'd say, that never happened in those states. And it is happening. Let me end with a different story than the one I was going to tell you. Can we get there is the question I just got asked. Let me share with you a story about Alfred Nobel, a famous Scandinavian arms maker. Discovered dynamite, sold weaponry all over the world, and that's how he made his fortune. He had a brother who was involved in cultural affairs, a bit younger than he was, and the brother died first. And there were obituaries about his brother. He was pretty well known. What? Do you know this story? No. There's an obituary in a French newspaper called, Paris newspaper called Francois. And it says, and a friend of his sees it and sends it to him up in Norway. And another friend gives it to him. And it says, munitions maker dies, merchant of death, made huge fortune. And Nobel looked at it and he said, that's not my brother's obituary. They've written the wrong obituary. That's my obituary they've written instead of my brother's obituary. He said, that's the worst thing that's ever happened to me. And his friend said, no, it's not the worst thing that's ever happened to you. It's the best thing that's ever happened to you, because from now on, you can change your life and rewrite your obituary. And that's when he set up the Nobel Prizes. Ladies and gentlemen, we have not had our obituary written. We can rewrite it, but it is up to us to do it. Thank you.
That's a great story. That's a great story. Yeah, stand up. Stand up.